There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The past is actually a representation of who I am now, rather than who I am now is a representation of my past.
I want to write this down because I feel like that just blew my mind.
Yeah. So when you're thinking about neuroscience and you're even just thinking about memory in general, memory is always a reconstruction in the present. So if I was to think right now about last week, that would be different than if I was thinking about it a week from now. And a week from now, I'll be slightly different. I'll be in a different context. And so if I'm thinking back a few weeks, I'm gonna be in a different place. And so the main thing is that who you are in the present is basically what is creating the past. Obviously, the past influences who you are in the present. It's kind of a circular. But memory is always a reconstruction in the present. And one of my favorite psychologists, he wrote a book called Time and Psychological Explanation. His name is Brent Slife. But he said that it's more accurate to say that the present causes the meaning of the past than to say that the past causes the meaning of the present.
How would you offer advice to somebody who feels like, this all sounds cool, Dr. Benjamin, but I'm literally locked in the moment right now. And I don't have a lot of headspace or slack in my life to do anything otherwise.
Yeah, definitely. One thought I will say to this person that you're describing is like, it's very common to get absorbed in the present and to think that the present is all that matters rather than to kind of thoughtfully look at it, maybe get in touch. And getting in touch with your future self is very similar to just honestly meditation. It's not the same as meditation, but it could be a form of meditation. And so I would argue if you're not taking time regularly, even to just sit and just like think for even like 5 or 10 minutes, but like that everything feels too overwhelming, then you're, from my view, you're definitely like probably off course. And like, so getting connected to the future self, a lot of it's just really about like, am I on the right track? Am I on a track I want to be on? Do I like this? It's really a way of having conversations with yourself. It's very in line with just the whole framework of important versus urgent, right? And so it's like if everything feels urgent and you're not connected to what's important, then you're probably not making massive strides forward. You're probably on autopilot. You're probably on the hamster wheel. So I think it's extremely important, even if you feel stressed, even if you feel busy, even if you feel like you don't have those 5 minutes to just go and sit in your journal and just write all the things you're you probably need that more than anyone. But you never reach a point when you don't need that. You never reach a point when you don't need those 10 minutes. It's a continuous process of clarity and of making progress and of learning to prioritize and learning self-awareness. And so we all need it. We can all get overly absorbed in the present by the stresses of it and then downplay our future. So I think it's very common.
Yeah. I'm just jotting this down, but I want to ask in a moment about trauma because I feel like it adds a bit of a different piece to it. But two things are coming to mind right now is, you know, if someone had 5 minutes and wanted to start this, like they're bought in, what would somebody do? I've got 5 minutes of my day. That's all I got. What would be the practice that I get into?
I would honestly actually start, if you only are going to give yourself 5 minutes, period, flat, actually do it at night.
Okay.
So do it at night. And if you would or could, research shows that 90% of people procrastinate sleep by just mindless scrolling. And so they're literally procrastinating sleep and literally putting their future self in a hole the next morning because of mindless consumption. So, and we all, you know, that's very common. And so it's, in my view, what you do in the last hour of your day is the most potent form of habit formation. So like what we do at night right before we sleep is going to inform our habits way more than any other period of the day. And so a lot of huge amount of research on this, that if you just simply at the end of your day, pull out your journal and just write down three things from that day that you are grateful for. It's so basic, but it's shown dramatically to increase happiness and to increase sleep quality. Hmm. It just gets things down, but also if you just give yourself 3 to 5 minutes, a lot of times because people are not practiced at this, and I have different iterations of this. I have, in my mind, a lot deeper forms of reflection than just simply writing what you're grateful for. But this is like honestly just a start because it trains people to look back at the day and to think about it and to just simply say, and then the initial reaction, if I ask my older three kids who are teenagers, what are you happy about from the day or what are you grateful for? I'll sometimes just say literally nothing. Hmm. And it's like, well, then think about it. Hmm. What happened today? What could you be grateful for? And so by actually thinking about it and pondering it, they'll say, well, actually, you know, that person at work was super nice to me. I'm grateful for that. Like, so now they're starting to take ownership of their past. They're starting to create the frame. They're starting to actually pull usefulness from it. And so they can then think, well, today actually was pretty great. Or there was components of today that were all right. And so just by simply doing that, that's a great start. My view is you can take it a step further.
Because that would be that would be kind of providing meaning or kind of looking back and reshaping how you're interpreting now. Like that's
what you're doing.
Right? Reflection.
You are shaping the meaning of the past in the present, in your journal. And you're now framing the day as useful.
Yeah. Okay. And so I think that idea of like gratitude journals makes sense. I'm curious how it connects to the future self part. Because look, you know, reflection is a different mechanism than looking forward. So then what's that piece look like?
Yeah. I gotcha. Well, so here's how I do it. I actually don't do it in that form, but that's like honestly basic.
Okay.
Like if people really want to get started and they only have 5 minutes and they're not. So how I do it is, and this is still starting with the night. How I do it is at the end of the day, I think, how am I different from who I was when I woke up? The reason this is super important, I know that this is not future self, this is me again re-relating to my past self, is that if I thought about it, just like with thinking about those three gratitudes, if I actually think about it and I say, how am I a different person than I was this morning when I woke up? The initial reaction would be, I'm not. It's only been like 12 hours. How could I be different? But if I really think about it, what do I now know that I didn't know before? What experiences have I had that my prior self hadn't had when I had just woken up? And if I actually think about it, just like gratitude, I'm creating the frame of my past. I actually can and do see that I am different than my past self, even 12, 13 hours ago, or the night before, 24 hours ago. And by actually focusing on that, and by appreciating that, I now acknowledge that I've changed, which increases my psychological flexibility. It allows me to see that I am not the same person, that I am growing, that I am evolving, which is really useful for then getting skillful at thinking of your future self as a different person. If I'm different from who I was 24 hours from now, then it's likely that my future self could be different in 24 hours in positive, meaningful, and even self-directed ways. And so I just think that it's really mastery of the past is very powerful for also developing mastery of your future. So I don't know if you wanted to note that. I'm very happy to share starter points on getting connected to the future self, but I just think that it's incredibly useful to recognize the differences between your current and your past self. And also very useful to be explicit about that. And by writing it down, that's actually part of the integration process. It actually creates change that would not have been there if you hadn't done that process. If I didn't do that at night, then there are certain changes that would not have occurred because I didn't think about it and because I didn't frame it and because I didn't make it explicit and say, oh, here's how I'm different from my past self. You know, maybe I was a lot more thoughtful in this conversation, right? Than maybe I would have been a week ago or even than I was yesterday. And so by writing it down, I've now made that change more potent than it would have been had I not done that. And so I think that that's really powerful. I would say one other really important thing here is in recognizing that I'm not my past self, whether it's 24 hours ago or whether it's 10 months ago, I have nothing but empathy for my past self. I'm not carrying around a past self that I'm angry at. I don't have any regrets because I'm not the same person as my past. They were operating from a different framework. The future self is the same. My future self is insanely empathetic towards my current self. My future self has way more wisdom, perspective, context than I do. And so it allows me a lot of freedom to make mistakes, which is a huge aspect of having a growth mindset. Fixed mindset means you're afraid of making mistakes, afraid of trying new things, afraid of you know, being wrong. I mean, a fixed mindset means that you really are dogmatic and fragile, and so you don't want to be wrong. Whereas if I know that my future self has better perspectives, then I'm okay making mistakes. I'm okay trying new things.
I think people need to hear that. I think that's really powerful. Or like, I'm curious on the trauma side. So I just came across this stat that 60% of Americans will have trauma in their life and have PTSD. And so to me, that's not just, I mean, part of it's having empathy for your past self, but there's a moment or something locked in time or a trigger that's just causing you to keep getting pulled back there. How could this be applied to help somebody get unlocked from something that feels very traumatic in that way?
Yeah. Obviously, we, you know, you're not given the toolkit when you're born to having what I'm calling psychological flexibility. This is a really high bar of what would be called emotional intelligence. But the more emotionally intelligent you get, again, the less dogmatic you see a certain thing. And so from my view, trauma is typically, certainly it was an insanely unexpected, painful emotional experience that is continuing to impact you now. Even if you're long away from the experience, if the trauma is still impacting you, then you're still framing it such that it's still actually happening, which is really interesting. There is a lot of research that even shows, obviously, having a conversation about it with someone is useful. Further research showing if you can just think about what you learned from it. So that's a big part of post-traumatic growth. I'm a lot more aggressive about it, frankly. Like, I'm regularly seeking to turn it into benefits as fast as possible, which is, it fits along the lines of anti-fragile versus fragile. So like, anti-fragile is a framework created by Nassim Taleb, but it's really about how no matter what happens to you, whether you're at a peak or in a valley, whatever, if it's something negative, you're as soon as possible turning it into benefits, turning it into gains would be the language that we use.
Anti-fragile is what it's called.
Oh, yeah. Anti-fragile means it's the opposite of fragile. So fragile means if something negative happens, you know, you're worse off as a result. It creates more entropy into the future. And that's also a view where the past is driving the present. Yep. But if you recognize that it's actually the present that drives the past, that, you know, and I'm talking purely in psychological terms, that it's the present.
The meaning of the past.
Deeply, yeah. It drives the framing of the past, the context, which determines the content, the angle. And so if I know that, even if I, you know, this is not as traumatic as we're talking about, where we're talking about PTSD, although, you know, I've gone through extreme trauma, adopted three, you know, kids went through the foster system who they've had trauma. But even if I have a conversation, say, with my 15-year-old son, and it just doesn't go well, like, I honestly, I don't handle it well. I have a choice. Like, I either can reshape the meaning of that conversation, turn it into something beneficial, turn it into learning and growth, or just let it be. And if I don't do anything about it, then the past is going to dictate the present rather than the present dictating the past. And so, from my standpoint, it's just very useful for me to know that either on a time frame, so let me just say, like, from here to the last year, or specific events, I have a lot of control over what those mean. I have a lot of control over framing what it means. What does my last year mean? What was the good of it? What was, you know, do I want to look at it from a positive or from a negative, but also specific events? My parents getting divorced, right? Me being in a car crash that almost kills my mom, right? I can think on certain events and I can say, well, there's one of two ways. Either my present is shaping it or it's shaping my present. And usually with trauma, the past is still determining the present. There isn't a lot of proactive in the present, taking control, approaching it, and wanting to do something about it. It's not going to change in a positive way by chance. Mm-hmm. It literally has to by choice. And at some point, you have to directly approach it and decide, I'm going to do something different here. I'm going to look at this different.
Everything is approach or void. Wow.
Everything is approach or void.
I feel like I've got so many questions forming, but you mentioned
go ahead and throw it. I mean, we can work
on second
this.
Framework you wanted to bring up, and so I just want to circle back.
I mean, I don't know if it's directly useful anymore.
Okay.
I think that I just want to emphasize really quickly what we're saying, that the past is either an asset or it's a liability. And if it's an asset, that means it's something that's continuing to pay you more and more. You believe that the present and future are better as a result. That because of that experience, you're continuing to get kind of interest in the present and future. Whereas if it's a liability, you believe it's continuing to drain your present and future. And that is all based on how you're choosing to frame it, what you're choosing to do with it. And in the beginning, you may not feel like you have choice in the matter. Like, how could you see it any different?
Yeah.
And that's like the ability to get to the point where you start to try and you start to believe that it's possible, and then you start to work on it, maybe even start to get help in looking at it from a different angle, starting to learn from it, starting to think that it was something useful. Even if you could find reasons, just like finding things you're grateful for at the end of the day, you've got to like actually exert some creativity on it. You have to actually like, it is creativity, as much as creativity towards your future.
The mind that is anxious about future events is miserable. We cannot choose our external circumstances, but we can always choose how we respond to them. A ship should not ride on a single anchor, nor life on a single hope. If you know not to which port you sail, no wind is favorable. Let the personality be made ready to face everything. Let it be made to realize that it has come to terrain on which thunder and lightning play. A blazing fire makes flame and brightness out of everything that is thrown into it. Loss is nothing else but change, and change is nature's delight. No man is more unhappy than he who never faces adversity, for he is not permitted to prove himself. How ridiculous and how strange to be surprised at anything which happens in life. Difficulties are things that show a person what they are. You don't develop courage by being happy in your relationships every day. You develop it by surviving difficult times and challenging adversity. Anyone capable of angering you becomes your master. He can anger you only when you permit yourself to be disturbed by him. How much more grievous are the consequences of anger than the causes of it? Associate with those who will make a better man of you. Welcome those whom you yourself can improve. The process is mutual, for men learn while they teach. The key is to keep company only with people who uplift you, whose presence calls forth your best. Other people's views and troubles can be contagious. Don't sabotage yourself by unwittingly adopting negative, unproductive attitudes through your associations with others. Adapt yourself to the life you have been given and truly love the people with whom destiny has surrounded you. It is not because things are difficult that we do not dare. It is because we do not dare that things are difficult. If you are pained by an external thing, it is not this thing that disturbs you, but your own judgment about it. And it is in your power to wipe out this judgment now. How does it help to make troubles heavier by bemoaning them. You suffer more than necessary if you suffer before it is necessary. The trials you encounter will introduce you to your strengths. Difficulties strengthen the mind as labor does the body. It isn't the things themselves that disturb people, but the judgments they form about them. If someone is able to show me that what I think or do is not right, I will happily change, for I seek the truth by which no one was ever truly harmed. It is the person who continues in his self-deception and ignorance who is harmed. There are two things a person should never be angry at: what they can help and what they cannot. Life is very short and anxious for those who forget the past, neglect the present, and fear the future. Do everything as if it were the last thing you were doing in your life. You may say, "It's unfortunate that this has happened." No, it's fortunate that this has happened, and I've remained unharmed by it, not shattered by the present or frightened of the future. It could have happened to anyone, but not everyone could have. Ask, why is this so unbearable? Why can't I endure it? You'll be embarrassed to answer. To be like the rock that the waves keep crashing over. It stands unmoved, and the raging of the sea falls still around it. Progress is not achieved by luck or accident, but by working on yourself daily. Even if some obstacle comes on the scene, its appearance is only to be compared to that of clouds which drift in front of the sun without ever defeating its light. Every difficulty in life presents us with an opportunity to turn inward and to invoke our own inner resources. The trials we endure can and should introduce us to our strengths. Prudent people look beyond the incident itself and seek to form the habit of putting it to good use. On the occasion of an accidental event, don't just react in a haphazard fashion. Remember to turn inward and ask what resources you have for dealing with it. Dig deeply. You possess strengths you might not realize you have. Find the right one. Use it. As long as you live, keep learning how to live. Remember, no human condition is ever permanent. Then you will not be overjoyed in good fortune, nor too scornful in misfortune. He is a wise man who does not grieve for the things which he has not, but rejoices for those which he has. The content of your character is your choice. Day by day, what you choose, what you think, and what you do is who you become. Make the best use of what is in your power and take the rest as it happens. It does not matter what you bear, but how you bear it. Never say of anything, "I have lost it." Only say that "I have given it back." As it is pleasant to see the sea from the land, so it is pleasant for him who has escaped from troubles to think of them. Just keep in mind, the more we value things outside our control, the less control we have. Freedom is the only worthy goal in life. It is won by disregarding things that lie beyond our control. In your actions, don't procrastinate. In your conversations, don't confuse. In your thoughts, don't wander. In your soul, don't be passive or aggressive. In your life, don't be all about business. The world turns aside to let any man pass who knows where he is going. Let us prepare our minds as if we'd come to the very end of life. Let us postpone nothing. Let us balance life's book each day. The one who puts the finishing touches on their life each day is never short of time. Don't hope that events will turn out the way you want. Welcome events in whichever way they happen. This is the path to peace.
Hungarian-Canadian physician and author Dr. Gábor Maté is known for his expertise in addiction, stress, childhood development, and the mind-body connection. With multiple best-selling books, he's reshaped the way we look at emotional behavior and well-being. One of Gábor's most profound quotes is, "Trauma is not what happens to you. Trauma is what happens inside you as a result of what happens to you." In this interview with Stephen Bartlett, he takes us deeper into this message with his perception of gut feelings.
But the problem for many of us is that we get disconnected from our gut feelings very early in life. No baby is disconnected from their gut feelings. Something happens to make us disconnect.
What is a gut feeling from a physiological perspective? Because gut feeling is used as a word to describe, you know, an intuition or, you know.
Well, real gut feelings really happen in the gut. In the Western way of looking at it, we tend to look upon the intellect and the intellectual brain as the only brain that we have. But actually, our brain is a far more complicated structure. And our heart has a nervous system, which is connected to the brain up here. And there's a kind of knowing in the heart. Sometimes people say, "I knew in my heart." And they did, if they're connected. Gut feelings are what all animals possess. It warns them of danger or when it's safe. And the gut is connected to the brain.
Right.
The gut sends more connections to the brain than the brain sends to the gut. And the gut has more of the neurotransmitter serotonin in it than the brain does. So that the gut feelings are here to tell us about what is safe and what isn't. And when the brain in the gut and the brain in the heart and the brain in up here in the head are connected, then we're grounded and present and very alert and very aware of what's going on. But when childhood trauma interferes with those connections, which it does, then we start to just work from up here. And we can think we can figure things just from up here. But actually, when you think about human beings, where did we evolve? We evolved for millions of years out in nature, How long does any creature in nature survive if they don't pay attention to their gut feelings?
Throughout his work, Gabor highlights elements, like that of the gut feeling, that we often overlook but can have physical implications. Being too nice can also have a physical impact on our bodies. When our mind doesn't have the strength to say no to people, our body does it for us. This can often result in physical illness.
There's two places to be very nice from. One is just genuine human compassion and concern for others, but you're still grounded in yourself. That's great. But a lot of people are very nice because they are afraid not to be. Because they weren't liked who they were, they weren't loved for who they were. Being nice was their way of getting the love and the attention they needed. Let me tell you a story. In 1870, there was a French neurologist called Jean-Martin Charcot, who was the first one to describe multiple sclerosis, which is an inflammation of the nervous system, very debilitating. And Charcot said, in 1870, without any scientific research, but just from his own observation, that this was a stress-driven disease. Okay? Now, since then, there's been a lot of research to show how stress and trauma potentiate multiple sclerosis. It's not even controversial. Not that any neurologist knows that. They don't get taught this stuff in medical school. But the research is there. Niceness, ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or known in Britain as motor neuron disease. There's been studies on ALS patients. They're extraordinarily nice. So there was a, from the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio, a major referral clinic, two neurologists published a paper at an international ALS or motor neuron congress. Why are ALS patients so nice? And what they described was that when people came to their office for diagnosis, before they met the physician, they had underwent EDX, electrodiagnostic testing of their nerves. And the technicians who performed the tests would write on the side of the test, this person can't have ALS, she's not nice enough. Or I'm afraid this person has ALS, they're too nice. And the physicians, the neurologist specialists said, despite the shortness of their contact with their patients and the obviously unscientific nature of their observations, invariably they turned out to be right. And then I called Dr. Wilburn, who did this study, and I said, what did the other neurologists say when you presented this? They said, yeah, we all noticed this, we just can't explain it. Since then, there's been a study where they've asked neurologists about their patients, and the answer is, all our ALS patients are extraordinarily nice. Now, what the neurologists don't do is they don't make the connection that that niceness is a repression of healthy anger, and that repression of healthy anger plays a role in the onset of that disease. So it's not an accidental connection. Again, niceness can come from genuine concern for others, but that's not accompanied by an ignoring of yourself. You also care for yourself. Then you can be as nice as you want. But you also know how to say no. And you also know how to set boundaries. You know how to be angry if you need to be. But the niceness that comes from self-repression, that's the one that hurts. So my contention is, as I said earlier, when people don't know how to say no, the body will say no for them in the form of illness. Mm. And for a lot of people with serious illness, the illness is the wake-up call.
Yeah.
And they actually learn. And when they do, that can make a difference to the course of their illness. Sometimes, not always, but I've seen examples of remarkable healing when people learn to say no and stop being people pleasers. It's very stressful to take on everybody else's issues and ignoring your own. It's very stressful. That stress has a physiological impact on the body.
Another external force that can cause unnecessary stress is social media. Gabor says it's not necessary to get rid of social media entirely, but when we diminish our attachment to it, we stop looking to the outside world for meaning and validation.
And you also suggest removing the things from your life that will stop you from seeing yourself, like social media.
Well,
because that can be a lot of feedback.
I can't remove social media from my life, but what I can remove is my attachment to it. For example, I don't have to look at the comments on all my talks on YouTube. Who says what? Who likes it? Who doesn't like it? You know, I'm not on Facebook. I don't have a I have a professional Facebook page, but I don't administer it. But people go on Facebook, and who says what? Who likes me? Who doesn't like me? You know, they can wean themselves off that. So we may not be able to stay off social media to write my books. Thank God for the internet, but I don't have to be attached to it. So it's using it, but not letting it use you, which is very hard. If I don't pay attention, rigorous attention to what's going on inside, and if I keep looking to the outside to give me meaning and give me validation, then I can lose myself. And that's what happened.
When we eliminate the external search for meaning, we are forced to look inward. Achieving this inner peace allows us to have compassion and empathy for not only ourselves, but others as well. Of course, the people and things around us have the ability to provide temporary happiness, but true fulfillment comes from within and has a much more prosperous and long-lasting effect on our mental and physical health.
Without inner peace, you're not going to be able to serve any of those goals properly.
Mm.
Or if you were, you do it at some risk to yourself. And so running around serving others in the name of this so-called higher goal undermines your inner peace. Then you're not on the right track. Inner peace is not a selfish goal. It's from a position of inner peace that we can speak compassionately and truthfully to others, that we can serve our other goals. But, you know, Eckhart Tolle talks about our inner purpose and our external purpose. And you stated a bunch of external purposes. And that's why there's the I believe,
mm-hmm.
if I may pardon the diagnosis, but or the analysis.
Right.
But that's why that disconnect that you mentioned. Because the goals that you stated were largely external.
Mm-hmm.
And what are the internal goals?
Inner peace.
Very good.
Yeah.
Now you have to put that into the mix. Because temporarily, when your book shows up as number one on the bestsellers list or shows up at all, you feel some inner peace. But it's addictive. And there's a wonderful physician and researcher, Vince Felitti, and he said, it's hard to get enough of something that almost works. And so, yeah, you can get that temporary inner peace, but look at the long-term consequences of the workaholism. It's not inner peace. I can tell you that. You know, I can tell you after a long experience, it doesn't matter even how successful you are out there. We started the conversation with this. It's never going to give you inner peace. Inner peace doesn't come from the outside. That's not a goal anybody ever handed to you. That's something that you have to come to yourself.
But how can we actually achieve inner peace? An effective practice used is meditation. One of the most popular forms of meditation is through controlled breathing. If we slow our breathing and focus on our body for a few short moments a day, we can become conscious of this subconscious bodily function and use it as a gateway to inner peace.
To go back to the question of what people can do for themselves, they can learn to breathe. And Eckhart Tolle, as a spiritual teacher, he says that rather than go to retreats and therapists, just take a few conscious breaths several times a day. Not to dismiss the other, but that's more important than anything else. And interestingly enough, the Buddha, when he was teaching his monks, in fact, one of the Buddha's assistants, Ananda, asked him, "Oh, Holy One, do you still meditate?" And he said, "Yes." "And what kind of meditation do you practice?" says Ananda. And Buddha says, "Observing the breath." So in Buddhist meditation, and I'm not here to advocate for any particular pathway, and I'm not a practitioner of any religion, but hey, this very wise man, he thought awareness of breath is the most important portal into reality.
In this insightful discussion, Matei demonstrates the path we must take to achieve inner peace. First, we must look inward for fulfillment, rather than outward. Second, we must understand that putting our own needs first gives us a larger capacity to help others. Finally, by utilizing certain methods, such as meditation, we can gain access to the consciousness needed to reach self-awareness, emotional resilience, and inner peace. Spiritual teacher and author Eckhart Tolle has guided millions towards a more meaningful existence. In a world consumed by the chaos of modern life, Eckhart's teachings serve as a pathway to connect with the present moment. In 1997, Eckhart wrote the book, The Power of Now, A Guide to Spiritual Enlightenment, where he goes deeper into this philosophy. He speaks of similar principles with his online presence and face-to-face lectures. In this lecture, he dissects the endless problem of looking to the future for happiness.
Now you begin to lose the present moment internally when the place you want to get to, whatever that may be, whether it's tomorrow or in 5 years' time, or even 5 minutes from now, you lose the present moment and your state of mind becomes somewhat or very dysfunctional when whatever goal you have or destination you have in the future occupies more of your attention than the present moment. If you don't enjoy the journey, which is always now, the step you're taking at this moment, if there's a lack of enjoyment, then you have lost the present moment, and the place you want to get to has assumed an importance that is becomes dysfunctional. I won't be happy until I have a private jet. It doesn't have to be big, just a little one. I cannot be fully myself unless I have a car that's better than most people's cars. And so you strive towards that, and in the meantime, you're not happy, because you're striving towards a place that promises some form of fulfillment, whether you call it happiness or having arrived, or this weird expression in the English language, making it. Making what? And then you have weird ideas in your mind. An enormous amount of fear arises because you have certain thoughts, especially at 3 o'clock in the morning. You wake up and the mind starts up and a weird word comes. I don't want to be a loser. A loser. Maybe I will be a loser. Maybe I'm not going to get this car. And maybe I'm not going to become the greatest this or that. Or maybe I'm not going to find the person who's going to make me happy. So always looking to some future moment, and then you realize on a practical level, future works. But on a deeper level, finding a true satisfaction in life, you have to look somewhere else.
Eckhart believes that we have anxieties and anticipations about the future because we compare it to the present. He has said that if the imagined future is better, it gives you hope. If it is worse, it creates anxiety. However, these comparisons are fictitious. In the balancing act of one's future with one's present, a person will inevitably cause both to fail.
What is the future that never appears, that can completely occupy our attention to such an extent that we lose the most important thing in life, and that is to be at home with yourself in the present moment, to feel where you are, to feel a connectedness with being. There's a deep peace, not a dead kind of peace, but an alive peace, to be rooted within yourself, to be yourself here and now in this moment. If you don't find the true meaning of present moment, of the now, then you live flitting around the surface of life. There's always some future moment to either be afraid of or be attracted to. No matter what situation you go into, no matter who you are with, and no matter what you achieve in life, always this sense of insecurity, of fear, of insufficiency, of some underlying sense of lack or something not quite right, always it resurfaces sooner or later, and usually sooner. many human beings who have achieved it. I've met quite a few, that was quite interesting, who in the eyes of the world had everything and they were unhappy. Now, the thing we need to recognize is no matter what you achieve, there's nothing wrong with achievement. But ultimately, that is not which is going to give you this sense of self that you are looking for, that sense of being rooted, that sense of security. What is the future then that everybody looks to? It's always associated with the thinking. It's a thought. On a deeper level, future is a thought in your head, and you only experience it ever as a thought in your head. That's the only reality future has. Isn't that interesting? It has no actual immediate existential reality except as a thought that you're thinking about some future moment. But even while you're thinking that thought, it's still the present moment and you don't even know it, because nothing can happen that's not in the present moment. And then there's the past. When you think about the past, again, where is the past? It's in your head. It's a thought in your head, or a lot sequence of thought in your head. So future and past are associated, intrinsically linked with the activity of thinking.
If thinking is what's taking us away from the present moment, then how do we stop thinking? Eckhart speaks of thinking as an addiction. It's not uncommon for the average person to spend every day going down the never-ending rabbit hole of thought. From one thought leading to another, it's nearly impossible to get in touch with the present. Eckhart teaches us some methods we can use to combat the ineffective state of thinking.
There's a lot of talk these days about addictions. Many people are addicted to all kinds of things. But one of the greatest addictions, you never read about it in the papers, because the people who are addicted to it don't know it, it's the addiction to thinking. Can't stop thinking. It's like can't stop drinking, can't stop smoking, can't stop eating, can't stop thinking. Thinking is the greater addiction than any of these. It's been around for so long, and it's a pseudo sense of self. So it's a great reluctance on the part of most people to let go of thinking. The main thing about it is presence. And presence is a space of no thought, but presence can also be there in the background even when thinking is happening. You can still be not completely involved in the thinking. Thinking loses the ability to create havoc in your life and confuse you. So your choice then is not to understand more or to bring some intellectual analysis to the practice, but to practice the state of not thinking, which can be arrived at by various ways, as you probably know. If you don't think about it, just do it. Becoming more aware of the present moment and accept it as it is slows down the overactive mind is one thing.
Eckhart is an advocate for the practice of meditation to quiet one's thoughts. He notes that the future will never actually arrive. Rather, it will come to us as a present moment. Through the numerous meditation sessions he has led, Eckhart encourages participants to fully embrace what is now, what is everything, and what will only ever be, the present.
A lot of the overactivity of the mind is an attempt to get away from the isness, the simplicity of the present moment. Present moment awareness means thinking subsides, may not disappear completely, but something else arises that is primary. We call it presence or awareness. But how do you become conscious of the present moment? Helpful things are sense perceptions, take you out of thinking, if you're not judging the sense perceptions, labeling, naming, looking around, without this compulsive interference of naming what you're perceiving. Oh, that's a beautiful flower, I wonder what it's called. I don't know what it's called, so that helps, I can be free of thinking. if I know what it's called, I can say, oh, that's such and such, and then drop that. See what it means to perceive without the interference of concepts, words. At this moment, for example, you're looking at me. Let's say between now and now, were you thinking? No. And while I speak, do you need to think to understand what I'm saying, or can you just listen and understand it? And when the so-called teacher stops speaking for a moment, the alert presence remains. It does not need to be filled with anything. Your priority is no longer to follow the thought where it wants to take you, because the thought has a magnetic pull. It wants more of your consciousness, but it wants to grow because it's a little entity. And in subtle ways, it tries to get your attention. It might even use a bodily feeling. God, I'm hungry suddenly. I need to eat something. And then you think of what restaurant am I going to afterwards? And so the presence is gone. You are gone. You are looking for a restaurant in your mind. Which means the thought used as some bodily thing to make thoughts out of it, completely pointless, because you can't find a restaurant because you're standing here. But it can use all kinds of things to get your attention. And if you're not careful, if you don't know the mechanism, it's not so much an intellectual understanding, but a simple realization that this is what the mind does. It tries to pull you in. Once you know that, you can allow a thought to arise without following it where it wants you to go, which is into another bigger thought and a bigger one.
One of the main driving factors for thought in our lives is what Eckhart describes as mental self-image. When we eliminate self-image, we go beyond hating or loving ourselves, and we can simply just be ourselves. This allows us to transcend the turmoil and confusion of everyday thought. When we withdraw our ego, we disregard the problems that are attached to it.
The essence of the awakened consciousness is that you go beyond having a particular idea in your mind that represents yourself, a mental self-image that you relate to. Because basically it's ego, a mental self-image. This is what I am, this is who I am. If you want to learn about not having a mental self-image, watch your dog or your cat. They don't have an opinion about who they are. They just are who they are. So that removes an enormous amount of problems from their lives. Of course, they don't have the mind activity that creates a self-image in their head. They are pre-mind, and therefore their life is far less problematic than human life. You can see how wonderful it is not to have a self-image. You can look at an ugly dog or an ugly cat. They don't have a problem with that. Even an overweight dog or cat, they're okay. No self-image. How wonderful to live without an image of who you are, because you are the presence. You're not the form that's a temporary expression of you, but you are the underlying presence. And when you feel yourself as the underlying presence, you don't need to live through some mental image of who you are. And that's where you go beyond hating yourself, but you also go beyond loving yourself. It's just being yourself. It's similar to the dog, but it's not a regressive step. It's a step forward for humans. You go beyond the mind-made sense of self. You don't fall back to the pre-mind-made sense of self. You don't need to live through a self-image of who you are. The more presence that comes into your life, the more you feel yourself to be the presence, not some mental construct. Of course, somewhere on the periphery of your mind, there may still be some. There is a little bit of a mental construct, but it does not provide the basis for your sense of identity anymore. The foundation for your sense of who you are is you are awareness, you are presence. And that's a liberation from the self-image. And that's wonderful. So it's not go beyond hating yourself and then also go beyond loving yourself. If you need to go through the stage of loving yourself because you cannot go directly from hating yourself to presence, then do. Go through the stage of loving and then step beyond that.
Throughout his work, Eckhart remains adamant that when we stop looking to the future for happiness, we are able to connect with the present moment. The best way to do this is break free from the chains of constant thinking and recognize excessive thought as an addiction. Through certain methods and practices, we are able to achieve this. Eliminating mental self-image becomes key here. It allows us to shed the burdens of self-judgment and societal expectations. Setting us free of the turbulence of negative everyday thought, we step into a world where the present moment unfolds, offering peace and clarity of our newfound selves. These teachings are only the tip of the iceberg Eckhart has to offer. Today he continues to teach, awaken, and guide us through the chaos of everyday life. There is something we can all learn from the timeless teachings of Eckhart Tolle.
Shop.motiversity.com, where inspiration meets artistry. Our canvases are your consistent reminder that growth is not just a destination, but a way of life. Available through TNH's parent company, shop.motiversity.com. Change the way you see your world.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.